was just before 7:30 p.m. on February 9th, 2004, when Maura Murray was last seen.
Her car was found damaged, locked, and abandoned on Route 112 just outside of the White Mountains of New Hampshire.
Her disappearance has haunted and frustrated family, friends, and a community of people searching for the truth.
Since that night, there has never been a credible sighting.
You're listening to the Missing Maura Murray podcast.
Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Today we have on an investigator that we have brought into the team. So we want to bring her on in just a couple minutes. But before we get into that, I just want to do this intro and talk about a few lingering issues. First of all, how are you, Lance?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well tonight. If you're on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, you've probably seen this FBI petition that has been going around that John Smith started. And we want to ask you to please sign this FBI petition to get the FBI involved in the Maura Murray disappearance. They were involved at one point very briefly early on, and then they asked the New Hampshire State Police if they wanted their help, and the New Hampshire State Police said, thanks, but no thanks, we got this. 12 years have gone by, turns out they definitely don't have this. So we understand that the Murray family desperately wants this, and it was pretty obvious from the letters that Fred Murray wrote to two different New Hampshire State governors about 10 years ago. So this is a man and a family that's begged for the FBI to get involved for a decade now, and it has not happened.
And it just goes to show you how aware they were of the situation before law enforcement became aware of the situation, knowing that the FBI needed to be involved. We don't know if this is actually going to achieve anything. We believe that we would need to present some form of contradictory evidence to prove that this was anything other than a runaway or that a crime was committed. So if there's some evidence out there that proves corruption, or one particular statement says one thing and there's evidence to contradict that statement, then they would probably have cause. This is stuff that we've learned through our listeners emailing us who are in law enforcement. We could then bring it to the FBI and show them just cause to open a case on this. However, it doesn't hurt to sign this petition, show that there is a huge public outcry to get something started with this case to bring some sort of closure to the Murray family. And through the contacts that we have, we know for certain that this is something that they would absolutely love to have happen.
And no matter what outcome you believe happened to Maura, you should sign this petition. You should want the FBI to get involved because it could help solve this. The only reason I can see that you wouldn't want the FBI to get involved is you're afraid that the FBI is going to take your entertainment away. And I really don't think that's fair to the Murray family. If you've been listening to this show and following this case, you owe it to the Murray family to sign this petition. And again, we don't know if this is going to work to get the FBI involved. And frankly, if we're talking about a police corruption situation here, we're not even sure that the FBI would not be corrupt. But the least we can do is try. I think there are a lot of good cops out there, but frankly, there are corrupt ones. And I know you guys have been watching Making a Murderer on Netflix. I know a lot of people have. And look, if you watch that, you cannot look at that and say, oh, there's no way. For those of you who emailed us, oh, I'm done listening to this show, they're talking about a conspiracy, there's an absolute chance.
Yeah, it's like when people get into a desperate situation and they see that everything is on the line for them, then they'll go out of their way to do what they can to make it right for them. You know, if they realize that they botched this investigation from the beginning, then they will go out of their way to make it look like they did not botch this investigation. And if we need to bring the FBI in to prove that, then I guess that's what we're going to have to do. Something that you said about people being worried about the case being closed and their entertainment being taken away. I mean, there's plenty of other things out there that you can be entertained with. Also, I find it a little bit more appealing to, if I was a listener, be a part of this and say, hey, I had something to do with that coming to some sort of conclusion. That there's now closure for the family, there's closure for her friends, and we went on this, and I'm using this term really loosely just because I can't think of another word, but we went on this ride all together, and we actually did something good. And that, to me, is way more appealing than you know, hoping that it continues on, because what am I going to do when it's done? I'm going to be bored.
The least you can do is sign the petition for the Murray family. If you don't do it for us, if you hate us, if you're one of these people who email us or write on Reddit how much you hate us, at least sign it. So maybe the show stops at some point. And the other thing I wanted to say is that we have gotten emails and tweets from people who are in the press, or people who write press releases or write for newspapers or TV stations or radio stations. And so we want to ask you specifically to do what you can to publicize this. Again, if you've been looking on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, you'll see that John Smith has gone ahead and had, I believe, two articles already, or there's a second one that's about to come out, two articles written about this in newspapers so he can get more signatures. We especially want your help if you're in a position like that, because you can bring more signatures than just the one from your own hand. And also ask friends, ask your family, tell them a little bit about the case. Don't really care if they listen. We're not looking for extra downloads, whatever. Just have them sign the petition. It's the least you can do if you've been entertained, if you've been following this.
And also, just something to keep in mind, we are coming up on the... In a little over a month, we'll be coming up on the 12-year anniversary. This is perfect timing, guys. Get out there. It's going to come around. It's going to be fresh in people's heads. I believe John Smith has organized a few billboards up in the area to be erected for Maura. And with any press that this is going to get, whether it's media by way of news broadcasts or newspaper articles, this is perfect timing for us to come together and try to do something productive here.
So thank you very much for that. We really appreciate that.
Well, and by the way, in between all of our the pauses or the breaks that we have in between the episodes, we gather a lot of information. And so if we sound like we're kind of going off when we start a show, it's because there's just a lot of stuff and we have to, you know, put it all in a little capsule and talk about what's most important and try to get it out as fast as possible. The good thing is that you guys are downloading it. So if you miss anything, just go back and listen to it again. And know that the things that we're saying are among the most important that we can talk about at the time, if that makes any sense.
And usually we use these intros for bookkeeping notes. So this is what we're doing here. And we have a couple more. On, I believe, episode 19, part one of the last interview we did with John Smith, I made a comment about how we got no criticism from the Crossing the Rubicon episode, and that was honestly a joke. And I know a lot of people really gave us some crap about that, or really gave me crap about that, saying, oh, these podcasters aren't listening to the comments if they really think that. Well, it was honestly sarcasm. I couldn't say that about any episode we did of this show. We get criticism for everything we do. So for me to have been serious there, it's an absolute joke in itself. And that one we probably got the most criticism for, maybe except for the psychic episode we did with Laurie Bruno.
You were joking on that one?
I was being sarcastic, and some people got it, you know, in their defense. That was pretty good. And I tried to explain myself on YouTube and on Twitter. But yeah, some people just didn't appreciate the humor. And I just thought everyone would get it, I guess. But my fault, my bad. We won't do it again. I don't want you to think that we lie to you guys, because we really don't. That was honestly a joke that that people took seriously, and maybe it just wasn't a funny joke.
One piece of confusion that I think we should clear up is one of the comments, or a couple of the comments, one of them being on YouTube. Some people were a little confused when John Smith stated that Witness A was passed by the 001 Haverhill Police SUV twice. Some people were confused as to how Witness A was passed twice. And we just wanted to clarify this, and the explanation for this is that 001, the SUV 001, took Cemetery Road off of Swiftwater Road, which would bring him onto Route 112 further back west, thus making it possible for 001 to pass Witness A two times. So basically, 001 double-backed and ended up passing Witness A a second time. One of our listeners, Alex C., further clarified and said there are roads that branch off to the left, the west, between Cottage Hospital and Route 112 off of Goose Lane. One of those roads, being Cemetery Road, connects back up to Route 112. The officer would have had to have taken one of these, turn right onto Route 112, then overtaken the Witness A's vehicle for the second time. He also says when you look at a map, you can pretty much clearly see it. So that was a really good comment by Alex C. So thank you for that.
Yes, and we want to encourage Alex C. to keep helping, because he goes on in the YouTube comments to comment about Mora's cell phone, which was a Sprint Samsung model SPH-A620. This is the phone that some people think Faith Westman mistook for a man smoking a cigarette, because there was a red light. And I know we spoke about this on an early episode, I think, about a red light on this phone. So Alex C. really went into depth, and he says he's downloaded and read the entirety of the user's manual for this model of phone, and the only red LED on the phone itself is on the external display when the phone is closed and you have a missed voicemail message. So in this case, the crescent-shaped LED light that he says looks like a smile below the external screen blinks red. He goes on to say, I think this blinking would be easy to discern even if one only glanced at the scene from their window briefly, and it would be difficult to mistake for someone smoking a cigarette. The phone itself has no constant red light ever. The only red light associated with this phone model is either on the desktop or travel chargers, both of which require being plugged into a standard wall outlet, not a car outlet. So these weren't being used at the time.
That is really excellent, because when you look at the statement, she says a red glow, right? So if she saw a red blinking light, she would say a red blinking light. Not to mention that that blinking light can't be any bigger than maybe half the size of your pinky nail. So that's impressive. That's impressive. I'm not going to theorize any more about what was in, like whether or not it was the cell phone or man smoking a cigarette, but it just further is, it's one of those things that just keeps nagging at you, right? It just keeps biting at you. And you, once you think that you've figured it out, well, oh, it's probably the cell phone, right? Because a cell phone has a red light. Yeah, and then you get someone who's read the entire manual on this phone and tells you, no, it'd be pretty hard to mistake this in that situation for a cigarette.
Yeah. So I'm not sure where that leaves us exactly, but that is the kind of comment that we really need from our listeners. And so I want to thank and applaud Alex C. for sending that. Please feel free to email us anytime, missingmoramurray@gmail.com. We'd love to talk to you, and we'd love to talk to any intelligent commenters who are going to do the research similar to what Alex has done.
Which I think is a really good segue into our guest tonight.
Absolutely.
Not only our guest, but somebody who has really become more of an investigator for us, and consistently amazes both of us with what she uncovers.
Yes, this is someone that we met maybe a couple of months ago. She emailed us asking how she could help. She wants to investigate with us. KF, welcome to the Missing Maura Murray podcast.
Thanks, guys. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for finally joining us. I think right when we started working with you, we had talked about having you on the show, but it was really, really early in everything. And in the couple of months that you've been working with us, you've gathered a lot of information, impressively so. First, I just want you to explain the reasoning behind you preferring us to not use your name.
A lot of thought went into that choice. And while I'm not inclined to be anonymous, I do think that my name not being associated with this investigation and this podcast really helps me in the records research specifically that I'm doing, in the contact that I have with various police departments and records departments related to the case. You know, Google is something that people use as a daily tool now, and I think I really want to be able to go at the records that I'm requesting for the podcast, but also just for the investigation in general as a private citizen, and that my requests are not interpreted as material for a podcast, but are interpreted as a private citizen looking to exercise their rights to get the information that's afforded to them.
That's pretty good. That's pretty important, because I think one of the things that Tim and myself have encountered is you have to kind of go through that barrier. You have to overcome that hurdle of explaining that you're not doing this to promote a podcast or to promote a documentary. You're actually trying to do something good. And yeah, so it's an important tool to have.
Anyone I've spoken with for the podcast knows my name. I use my full name with them. I tell them that I, you know, help out on the podcast and I'm helping produce, and that's what I'm doing. This is more for putting in, you know, the government records that I'm researching and getting for the show. I think it helps me to have that level of anonymity.
And also, we have received a boatload of emails stating that Lance and I do not understand a female's perspective on this case. And people saying, oh, two, you know, 30-something-year-old men, what do you know about a 21-year-old woman, college woman's point of view? You guys don't know anything. And so that was another reason we wanted to have you on, is to speak a little bit about the female perspective. But let me just say, I was also a college person in 2004.
I just want to say that not only do I not understand the perspective of this case from a female point of view, I don't understand females.
What's funny, Tim, is that I was one of those emails. If you recall back to the first email I sent to you guys, that was one of the, and I didn't say, like, you guys don't know anything, but I said, I think it's hard to speak to the thought process of a 21-year-old woman when you've never been one. And I don't pretend to know how every woman thinks just because I'm a woman, but I think that there are certain things that Maura was going through that I went through from her exact perspective of being 21, being a woman, being in college, and dealing with some of those same issues. And I do think that it doesn't mean that no one else can understand it, but I do think that it's a needed perspective.
I agree. And we actually got a little criticism. And when I reflected upon the criticism, I thought to myself, yeah, wow, that's kind of insulting. We had continually referred to Maura as being a 21-year-old girl. And we had someone email us saying she's a woman. She's a 21-year-old woman. I'm sick of hearing you guys say a 21-year-old girl. And at first I was like, oh, okay, they're splitting hairs. But, you know, a second later I'm reflecting on it, and that is insulting. It, you know, or not insulting, it's just naive. You know, it's naive on our part to say that. So I will make every attempt to address Maura as a 33-year-old woman.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and it's really just shorthand. We weren't trying to insult anybody.
But that's what I mean when it's like, it's just being naive.
And the first thing I wanted to bring up from a woman's perspective, because we got a lot of emails about this and you commented on this when we first met you, was about the things found in Morris' car. And you yourself said that that you have used Head and Shoulders at points.
Sure.
And that is something that women do. And also Pickles. We got I can't even tell you how many emails or tweets we got saying, oh, Pickles are a low-calorie snack. A lot of women eat pickles.
They're a no-calorie snack.
See? That's why we need you.
I think it's hard. I think it's hard as a young woman to hear a man comment on what is and is not unusual for a young woman to have in her car. Because I'm not going to comment on what is or isn't unusual for a man to have in his car, because I don't know.
You just said that and I'm seriously getting like embarrassment sweat. I don't know how much we went into what she had in her car, but
we did a whole episode about it.
With you saying that and looking back on what we actually said, it is, and I acknowledge, a little unusual for two 30-something men to be commenting on what is in a 21-year-old woman's car. As if we're experts on anything.
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 I do think that going through what was in the car in that episode, I think it was valuable because I think it was information that a lot of people hadn't had access to. However, I think that it's very difficult without having a real understanding of what Maura's plans were that day to make judgments on what should or should not have been in her car. Because when someone's car is packed up for a trip, it is very different than what is probably in someone's car just on their average day going to work or going to class. So without really understanding her exact plans, I think it's hard to say what was unusual that was, you know, amongst her belongings.
Yep. Well said.
Is there anything else that we have missed blatantly that you believe we should know or that the audience should know that we've missed from a female perspective?
I wouldn't say missed blatantly. I don't think you guys have glossed over or ignored anything by virtue of not being women. I think it comes more down to the understanding of kind of how women think in certain situations. And I think that's perhaps what is a little lacking in a lot of the talk about this case is, you know, we hear a lot about what Maura's state of mind may have been and Butch Atwood and, you know, she would have been afraid and all. We hear a lot about what she probably was thinking, what she wasn't thinking. And I think there is this element that, you know, she may have been intimidated by Butch Atwood. She may have been afraid. If someone else had stopped to help her, she may have been intimidated by them as well. But I think it more comes down to, and there's been a number of articles online, I think, within the past year about this, of things women have to think about that men don't. And I think that's more what it comes down to for me with this night for Maura is, you know, we think she probably stopped for gas. We think she probably stopped at an ATM on campus. We don't really know, but I even had an experience last night where I was in the CVS by my house and this guy started following me in the store. And he was an older guy, you know, kind of seemed a little bit out of it, but was clearly following me. And I found myself hyper aware of that. And not totally sure exactly what to do in that situation. And so I think of Maura, I think of her in moments like that. And I think of, you know, yeah, I think there might've been tough things going on in her life, in her personal life, but I more think of her going up, stopping maybe somewhere in New Hampshire and kind of being on the defensive, being on guard. And I think that's kind of, as young women, that's what we're taught to do. We're taught to be hyper aware of our surroundings. We're taught to be aware when somebody looks at us twice. We're taught to pay attention when a man is following us. We're taught to pay attention if someone's walking behind us and we don't know who they are. I think there's just all these elements of fear and caution that I experience in my daily life as a single woman, you know, living in the city and just trying to be aware of my surroundings and about people around me. And I think of Maura in moments like that because I don't know what she was feeling, you know, at that gas station in rural New Hampshire, if that's where she stopped and filled gas. I don't know what she exactly was feeling when she, when her car, you know, whatever happened to it, when her car stopped on Route 112 late at night or early in the evening, but when it was dark, I have to imagine she felt afraid. Whether there was someone there that she knew or whether there wasn't, I think that to me is kind of my worst nightmare. I think I would be scared no matter what. No matter where Maura was coming from, she had to be scared because I'm sometimes scared walking from my car to my apartment door.
All right, so let's get into the research that you've been doing. So where would you like to start with that? The 17 article?
Sure. Yeah, we can start with the 17 article.
Good. I'd like to start with the 17 article because this is something that it was one of the earlier things that you worked on, and it was something that was really important to us because it was taking us right back to one of the first independent accounts of what happened, correct? And you can take it from here. Tell everybody when it was released and some of the information in there, and then we'll talk about it.
I mean, this article is pretty hard to find. There's there's not a lot of resources for getting magazines from the early 2000s, surprisingly enough. But anybody that wants to read the article, you can actually get 17 compiled a book of some of their best true crime stories. And I bought it on Amazon. And that's what ultimately ended up giving me the information to look up and contact the author. There were some things in the article that never really made it past that point. They never really ended up getting picked up in other news stories or in other resources surrounding this case. But the writer, her name is Vanessa Gregoriadis, and she is she's a very successful journalist, actually. And one of the things that got us excited about this article to read it and really use it as a resource was that it was written so close to the time of Maura's disappearance. This article was published in July of 2004. In 17 magazine. Vanessa spent obviously time before that doing research for the piece and also speaking with family, speaking with her friends, and doing some, I have to say, the resources that she shared with us, I've been very impressed with the depth that she went into and really talking to people that were close to Maura, talking to people that were involved in the case up in New Hampshire, talking to people on the police force. She really covered all of her bases and did a great job of, I really think, presenting a very well-rounded account of Maura's disappearance as of July 2004. And we all know, and you all know, those of you listening, that a lot has happened since then. And also a lot has not happened since then. There's been very little progress in this case. Obviously, we haven't found Maura yet. But going back to that time was able to really give us some insight into what the people close to her and what the people close to the case were feeling at that time, but also what they were thinking. And I think 12 years or going on 12 years, it's a lot of time for people's memories to change. It's a lot of time for people's perspectives and opinions about maybe what something means changes. And I think it's been really helpful for us to kind of go back to the facts and go back to statements that people actually made at that time.
And one thing that was interesting to me that you brought up when we were discussing Vanessa and her research into the case and what she came up with for her article. Can you tell me what her feelings were, or what she said to you when you first approached her about the case and it being 12 years later? Where was her mind at with this case? Was it fresh in her mind? Did it leave an impact on her? Before we get into the actual article, I'm just very interested to hear what she thinks 12 years later after she wrote this article.
She was definitely surprised, I think, to be contacted about this article. I think, you know, she's obviously written a lot of pieces since then, but this was one that stuck out in her mind on some level. And I think even at the time, I was very impressed that she still had her notes. And I think that that just speaks to her integrity as a journalist, but also that this case was something that she really had a lot of content for, that she really generated a lot of information, and not all of it could make it onto the pages of the magazine, but that this research, you know, she had spent a lot of time and put a lot of effort into doing it, and that it was worthwhile to her and it was important. It's disturbing to us, and it's disturbing to someone like her who dealt with this case so long ago that it still remains unsolved. I don't think she imagined that 12 years ago when she wrote this case, that we would be sitting here in 2016 kind of still as confused as they were in 2004. She was curious about why we were seeking this information from her, why we were contacting her, and what we wanted to do with it. And that's where it kind of came to me to explain the podcast and explain that the mission of this podcast, of all the work that you guys are doing, is to really give closure to Maura's family, to find answers for them and kind of do whatever it takes to help them finally get some closure on this case. And I think for her, as someone who had been involved kind of right towards the beginning, she was happy to help now. And I think she very much would like for the family to have closure as much as any of us.
Do you have any insight as to what it possibly could have been her state of mind, or the way she was thinking when she first wrote the it's not an article, right? Because it's bigger than an article. It's more like an expose or something. But do you have any insight as to where her head was at? Did she know that it would have this sort of resonating feeling later? Was that kind of her intention, was to memorialize the accident?
Every month of 17 has a true crime story in it. And this true crime book was like a compilation of their favorites, of like the best of.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I think at the time, you know, journalists like Vanessa, journalists out there, they they write a lot of articles about cases like Maura's. And I think at the time, there was mystery surrounding it. There was curiosity. It wasn't something that had been talked about that much in national media at the time, which was kind of one of the things she shared with me, that this before this article, it wasn't necessarily headline news. But no, I don't think she or anyone else that wrote about this at the time, and I've spoken to other journalists who wrote about this years ago, I don't think any of them expected that this would be something that they would still be talking about now, mostly because I think they thought there would be some sort of conclusion, but also because I think the curiosity around cases like these tends to diminish over time. And I think with Maura's case, in a lot of ways, it's increased, and that's very unusual.
I think you just answered something that has been a big question. Man, I'm going to have to think about this, because you actually did just answer something that is like, why is this case so fascinating? And it's because it came out right at the edge of regular media and social media. And right now, reporters get on this case and report about it because of what they've learned through social media. But there was that period of time between, say, 2004 and maybe 2008, where everybody was learning about social media. And this was in that magic spot of a mystery that just keeps evolving, and now we can contribute to it through social media.
One of the things Vanessa shared with me was that after this article was published, the editor of 17 contacted her to let her know that they had a pretty incredible response from readers to this article, that they had received hundreds of letters at the office of 17 magazine from young women reading the magazine, wanting to know what had happened to Maura, wanting to know more about the case, really eager to know if there had been any sort of resolution. And what was unusual about that was that those letters continued for years after. I think that ties into what you're saying, Lance, in the sense that this happened at a time when people didn't have social media to contribute their thoughts, opinions, theories, etc. And this is such a great manifestation of one way that people felt that they could connect with it, was to write letters to 17 magazine. And unfortunately, that's a very one-sided way of communication. And so there were a lot of people who I think would have been eager to help and provide resources and provide time. But unfortunately, there just wasn't, social media world just didn't exist on a level then where people could really work together and cooperate the way that I think we are now.
Yeah.
Vanessa was gracious enough to share a lot of her research with us and her notes. And there's been we found some really great information in there that we didn't know before, or information that had been watered down kind of over the course of the past 12 years.
What do you mean by watered down?
I think it's funny. I was explaining this to her. I think there's been certain things that pieces of information that someone has latched onto and kind of shared their own interpretation online. And unfortunately, those interpretations have then morphed into what people think are the facts. So, you know, the fact that Maura sends an email about, which we can talk about later, the fact that Maura sends an email about a comedy show that happens after she disappears means that she couldn't possibly have been upset enough to be trying to leave. And then I think that morphs into the fact being, well, she wasn't in a place emotionally where she wanted to leave.
Gotcha. Okay. So let's look at some of the material that Vanessa sent to you. And I'll let you kind of go with it. We have Sergeant Thomas York. Let's talk about him.
That was one of the people that she was able to talk to. And again, I think the value here is talking to him in 2004, when this case is still fresh and when the investigation is still really ongoing. I think the thing that stuck out to me most about his statement was his comment about the scent dogs. And I think this is one of those instances where what I'm saying, that we have this fact, and it's we have this fact that the dogs were able to trace Maura's scent about 100 yards from the car. That's the fact. That's, you know, kind of the baseline. And what's been read into that over time is, well, she clearly got into a car because the dogs lost her scent at a specific location on the road. Now, what Sergeant York said at the time was that the dogs were out there a couple days later, and it's really best to do dog scenting immediately after someone disappears, which obviously makes sense. I mean, other people are walking on that road, cars are driving by and moving everything around. But his opinion at the time, and I tend to agree, is that you have to take into account when you talk about where the dog lost the scent, that a factor in that may have been because the trail was old. Of course, it is possible that it ends because she got picked up at that spot, but it's equally possible that the scent had been compromised over those couple of days and that that's where it ended. So I think that's a situation where we kind of take this as fact as her scent ended, therefore she got into a car. And I think we have to be really careful to go back to the original facts and say, well, maybe that's true, but maybe it's really just because the area was compromised by regular road traffic.
Right, because it had been a couple days later.
Right, exactly. It wasn't immediately after it happened.
That little addendum never pops up when people are talking about this. It's always like the dogs lost the scent after 100 yards. So if you're new to the case and you're looking into it, you read that and you say, wow, they had dogs there. Like, you know, they had dogs there. You know, they had dogs there immediately, or they had dogs there shortly thereafter. Sergeant Thomas York actually says the dogs were out there a couple days later.
Right. And I think he's even questioning the validity of using that as a piece of evidence. The police are questioning it at that time of saying, yeah, you know, we used this technique, but it didn't bring us any conclusive information.
Because of the time that had been spent between the disappearance and when they got the dogs there.
Did Vanessa speak to any of Maura's friends?
Yeah, Vanessa actually had access to a number of Maura's friends from high school and college. And one of the people that she was able to speak to from UMass was Kate Markopoulos. She's obviously someone that's come up on the podcast before. She's someone that comes up a lot in this story. But Vanessa was really able to speak to her as one of Maura's friends, one of her classmates, one of her fellow athletes. You can just tell from her interview with Kate at the time that Kate is really confused about what is happening. And as this is kind of going on around her, she's trying to figure out why Maura would leave. Not why she would disappear, but why she had left UMass that day. And I think Kate was as much in the dark as any of us, and as any of us are now and as anyone was at that time. You know, she said that Maura didn't seem bummed out or more stressed out than usual, that nursing was a really stressful major, and that she had a lot of schoolwork and a lot of responsibility that went along with that, but that, you know, it wasn't anything out of the norm at the beginning of that semester. She said that Maura stayed up late doing homework a lot, that she would work. We know that she had that security desk job where she would be out until really early hours of the morning, and then probably have to go back and do homework before getting up for class the next day. None of these things were unusual in Maura's schedule to Kate. And one of the statements that she did make was that Maura didn't really have any other friends except for me and Sarah. And when she says Sarah, she's talking about Sarah Alfieri. And that's something that I think, you know, is worth talking about. She had transferred to UMass. She was still fairly new there. It's a big school. But Maura had been very involved with a number of things, including athletics. And so it does seem a little unusual for her to only have really two close friends when she had been on a sports team for a number of semesters. She was in a nursing program, which was highly competitive, but also I have to assume from what I've heard that it was a program where people really knew each other because they were spending a lot of time together doing different clinical rotations, studying, etc. So it does strike me as a little, I don't think strange is the right word, but maybe more of an indication of Maura's personality.
Well, I'm going to have to maybe disagree a little bit there, because there's a difference between having one or two close friends and being friendly and associating with other people. And you can have your sports team and you can, you know, go out to outings outside of the sport, you know, the actual activity of the sport, and you can bond with your fellow athletes, but they still might not be considered close friends. So I really don't find it that odd that her saying she didn't really have any other friends except for me and Sarah. I really don't find that odd at all. Maybe it's something in the case where it's like she could talk to everybody, but the only people she really felt comfortable confiding in or, you know, spending an evening with was her and Sarah. And personally, I don't think that people have many more than two or three, maybe four close friends in their life that they can actually say that about.
I think when I say it seems unusual, I'm using Maura's high school friendships, I guess, as a mirror to this. If she's coming from this tight-knit group of seven girls from high school who, by all accounts, she had kind of lost touch with over her time, especially since she had been back at UMass. So in some ways, I totally agree with what you're saying. And in others, it seems unusual to me for Maura, based on her past, that she wouldn't find a new kind of group of girls to hang out with. But maybe that was part of what was tough about transferring in so late at UMass, that a lot of those friendships are kind of forged in freshman year.
The next thing I want to talk about is something that I was really convinced about in the early stages of this case, and even in the early stages of this podcast: Fred and the motel, and where did Maura sleep in the hotel room and all that. And can you talk about that as far as what Fred actually talked to Vanessa, correct?
Yeah. I was always curious about that as well. It seemed confusing, but to me, I think I identified it more as, okay, we don't have the facts to make up this part of the story, and that's why it's confusing. And so Fred did speak with Vanessa specifically about, you know, the accident in the Toyota and that night. And one of the things that Fred is quoted in Vanessa's notes as saying is that Maura was crying in the other bed, and I was with the phone book on the other bed, which to me makes it pretty clear that it was a motel room with two beds. That explains in as much certainty as anything can, how she could have come in quietly into the room and laid down in the other bed, and he wouldn't have known she was there until the next morning.
Great.
So I just wanted to let the audience know that, you know, if you want to read this original 17 article, we are going to tweet out some screenshots probably right around the time this episode airs. So you can check those if you want, because what we're talking about now is things that didn't quite make the cut of that article. These are the journalist's notes. With that said, KF, what did Vanessa write down about after talking with Fred?
She took a lot of notes about her conversation with Fred, but I think one of the things that really stuck out to me in reading them was her notes about their interaction at the motel after Maura had crashed the Toyota. And I think one of the things that Vanessa notes is that Fred is talking about that Maura wouldn't let him buy her clothes. That she instead said, you know, buy my textbooks. You're paying for school, so you should be buying my textbooks, not buying me clothes. And describing Maura's relationship with him, said that she was very considerate of not causing me any expense or problems. And I think we've heard that from Fred before, that Maura was very sensitive to him. And you know, he said many times that her crashing the Toyota, if that was the worst thing she ever did in her whole life, that, you know, that was fine. And I think this is the same tone of his talking to Vanessa, that, you know, Maura was very responsible. She cared a lot about him, and she didn't want to inconvenience him in any way, whether it be financial or whether it be just, you know, causing him any sort of distress or worry.
And what did Maura's sister, Kathleen, have to say to Vanessa?
Kathleen's interview with Vanessa was, I think, for me, the most heartbreaking. Kathleen is being interviewed at a time when it's the 2-month anniversary of Maura disappearing. So we know that this was taking place, obviously, in the beginning of April. And she is just, throughout the notes about her time with Kathleen is really having a lot of trouble processing that this is still going on, and that Maura has still not been found. And I think I find that particularly heartbreaking, because that was 2 months later, and now we're almost 12 years later, and they still don't know where she is. And you know, at this time, we've talked about this. I know you guys have talked about this in past episodes, that Maura's belongings from her car were released to Kathleen. And at this point, at the 2-month anniversary of her disappearance, Kathleen was in possession of all of those of all of those items from Maura's car that were released to her. So she names, you know, that she had a couple of days worth of clothes. She had makeup, personal hygiene, her toothbrush, all the things that were left in the car. But she does talk about that at Maura's dorm, that Maura hadn't packed up her computer or things on her shelves. So as much as I think we've heard from a couple different sources that her dorm room was packed up, it doesn't seem like that was necessarily Kathleen's interpretation.
Right. You said had not packed up, right?
Yeah. She said she's saying that she didn't bring any of those things with her, that she didn't pack her computer. She didn't bring things from her shelves. You know, she hadn't packed those things. So,
which is interesting because we get a lot of people giving us feedback about Maura's dorm was packed. Maura's dorm room was all packed up. But that might not be exactly the case.
It's hard to say. I'm sure that the police have photos, would be my guess. At that point, she was declared a missing person by the time they were going through her dorm at UMass. But it's hard to say, really, you know, at what level her dorm was packed. Again, I think this goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier, where it's hard to know what's unusual for a person. Some people live out of suitcases and boxes for months, and you know, it was the start of a new semester. So I don't know. I don't feel comfortable making a judgment call on that. But Kathleen did talk about that while she had packed a couple days worth of clothes that were found in her car, she hadn't packed all her clothes. So it wasn't like she had packed all of her belongings, everything from her dorm to take with her, as though she were leaving her dorm for good.
So what does it mean when you pack a couple days worth of clothes?
I think it depends on the person.
That you're going away for a couple of days.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I think that's what Kathleen is saying. She, you know, she says a couple of days worth of clothes, makeup, toothbrush, the things that she names and the things that we know are found in Maura's car, to me, in all ways, I would feel comfortable, say, indicate a short trip.
And I'm not trying to say one way or another. I'm just saying at that time, this was April 2004, her sister, Kathleen, says she packed up a couple days worth of clothes.
Exactly.
Okay. Because that's really big in my head, because for a long time, I just imagined that everything in her dorm was packed up.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And what does Kathleen say here about the FBI? She says two hairbrushes went to the FBI?
Yeah. So she says that two of Maura's hairbrushes were submitted to the FBI. It did. Obviously, this was 2 months after, so any sort of testing that they were doing, there wouldn't have been results at that point. I don't know what kind of results were disclosed to the family later on, but I think maybe one of you guys can check the list. I don't know if one of the hairbrushes was from the car and one was from her dorm. I'm not sure what the sources of those brushes was, or if one of them was from her home. She had just spent the Christmas holiday with Kathleen. Maybe Kathleen had something at her house. I'm not sure.
I don't want to theorize too strongly, but it does sound like that Kathleen's talking about the things in her dorm. But also, we had heard about the FBI, the Massachusetts FBI, having been involved at UMass, going to UMass, and also talking to some of Maura's friends in Hanson, Massachusetts. But apparently the Massachusetts or the Boston FBI office never spoke to any of Maura's friends at UMass and didn't really go to New Hampshire to investigate. And as well, it's sort of the opposite. The New Hampshire FBI didn't go to Massachusetts. So I guess what I'm saying is I wonder, you know, whatever office took those hairbrushes, whatever FBI office took those hairbrushes, it sounds like the Boston one. But I wonder if those ever made it to the New Hampshire State Police. I mean, if it's just for DNA, that's one thing, you know, they would have gotten DNA another way anyway. But just saying, it's a little curious.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if maybe, you know, we might be, I don't want to diminish the case at all by saying this, but perhaps they were just taking the hair from the hair or the hairbrushes to have two sources of DNA so that they could definitely say this is Maura's DNA. So in the future, if they were to find, if there was a sighting of Maura later on and they found some hair at the sighting, they could compare it. I mean, is that what we're thinking, that's the reason why they took the hairbrushes?
That would be my assumption. There have been other cases out there where, unfortunately, they've used hair as a source of DNA, and it's, you know, someone else borrowed that hairbrush and it's been someone else's DNA. So I think anything you can do to really double down and make sure that you have the right the right thing in front of you. I think that would have been very smart of the FBI to take, if she had two hairbrushes, take them both and make sure that the samples match.
I think that seems like it, and I have no idea, but that seems like it would be kind of a standard operating procedure to not, you know, don't just give me one sample. I need something else from another source to corroborate this.
And then what did Kathleen say about her backpack?
Kathleen says at this point, so this is 2 months after Maura disappeared, that they are looking for her black backpack. She didn't like to carry a purse. And when she got out of her car, the guy that saw her said she was definitely carrying a black backpack. Now, I want to say that I don't know what guy Kathleen is referring to when she makes that statement. I can make some assumptions based on other things that I know, but I'm not sure who she was talking about. This was one of the things I had initially wondered, and I think I had in my initial email to you guys, was one of my questions of, you know, I don't go a lot of places without a purse or a backpack of some kind carrying my things in it. And that was one of my questions was Maura's bag, whether it was a backpack, whether it was a purse, was that missing from the car with her? And it seems to me that this statement tells me that it was, and that Maura didn't like to carry a purse, but that she was known to carry a black backpack, and that that was not found with the car.
Kathleen said the guy that saw her said she was definitely carrying a black backpack.
She might have been talking about Rick Forcier, saying that he saw somebody cross in front of his car, and I do remember him saying that it was somebody in dark clothing with a backpack.
Okay, and what does Maura's high school friend Katie have to say?
Katie's conversation with Vanessa was interesting to me because it brought up a couple of facts that I hadn't heard before, and I don't think they're super relevant or that they're going to crack the case, but I think it's always encouraging for us to see that this digging can bring up new information. In speaking about the group of girls that Maura was friends with in high school, Katie was saying that at first they really didn't know whether to take this seriously or not. Their first exposure to Maura being missing, according to this, was through her away message on AIM Instant Messenger. Was that there was an away message that popped up when they messaged her that said, if you have seen Maura in the last 2 or 3 days, please contact the UMass Police Department. They all thought it was a joke. They thought it was something funny that Maura had put up. You know, Maura was kind of a jokester. I think they thought it was some sort of trick that she was playing on them. But what they found out was that the police had actually come into her room and put up that away message to try to see if they could get contact from anyone who had seen her and didn't realize that she was missing.
And do you know how long it was between UMass Police Department finding out that she was missing or that this was actually a missing person case and when they posted that?
The away message said the last 2 or 3 days. She disappeared on Monday. So my guess is that they put it up towards the end of that week.
Okay.
Why would they, you know, ask any of her friends to contact the UMass Police Department? Why would the UMass Police Department have anything to do with this investigation?
It's just easier, I would suppose, for them to use the UMass enforcement or UMass Police Department as a channel to the state police or to the FBI or to whoever may have instructed the UMass Police Department to put this up.
So, Lance, I'm going to disagree with you. I think they still thought Maura was going to show up back at school.
That could be it too, yeah. And this is a way of them not taking it so seriously. Like, hey, we did our job.
And also that she may have shown up on campus and be staying with someone at UMass. That she maybe hadn't returned to her dorm, but maybe she was staying with another student. And so that was the purpose of this away message, to try to see if anyone had seen her on campus, if she had come back to UMass.
Interesting theory. Yeah, I'll take that back. I feel like that statement about them thinking that they were just kind of like mailing it in and doing their job, Maybe this is not uncommon. Maybe they've done this before. They put up this message, and you know, within a couple hours, someone's like, "Oh yeah, this person was with me."
College students are at this time, especially, you know, not as much now with social media and texting the way that we use it, but during this time, you know, college students were more likely to be reported missing by their parents, who couldn't get in touch with them, maybe for an entire weekend or maybe even an entire week, if they weren't able to get in touch with them on their cell phone. They wouldn't necessarily have the contact information for any of their friends. So I don't necessarily think that this was something very unusual for the UMass police.
And then Katie goes on to speak about Maura's sister's boyfriend being Billy Rausch's best friend.
That's right. I mean, that's the first time I've heard that. And I did confirm that with Vanessa that was what that meant. But yeah, Katie indicated that Julie's boyfriend at the time, that they had since broken up. So we know that this interview was happening sometime during April, May, or June of 2004, that Julie had since broken up with this person, but that Julie's boyfriend at the time had been Billy's best friend, which would lead me to believe that it was another student at West Point, another cadet. This doesn't necessarily surprise me, especially because in her notes, Billy did tell her that Julie was the one who had actually introduced the two of them at West Point, had introduced Billy to Maura. I don't know if it really matters.
I don't know if any of it matters.
It's just interesting. It's stuff that we haven't heard before. If it's out there, it's so buried amongst other details or non-details. So just to be clear with that, Julie's boyfriend was best friends with Billy. And through that connection, Billy was introduced to Maura.
Correct.
But at the time of Maura's disappearance, Julie and that particular boyfriend, Billy's best friend, had broken up.
I don't know if it was when she disappeared. It was when this interview happened.
Oh, that's what I meant. Gotcha. Okay.
Would you like to read the emails that we have from Maura that had been provided to Vanessa by Maura's high school friend, Liz Druniak?
Yes, absolutely.
This is something that when you sent this to us, I read this a few times and I don't know. Once again, it's just something that that's not put out there a lot, and it shows personality, and it just hits home one more time that this is a human and someone who had a sense of humor and personality, and no one knows where she is.
I think these emails have been paraphrased online a lot, and I think we knew certain elements of them, but I think really reading in Maura's voice, I think reading what she wrote and how she wrote it did give me kind of a different insight into who she was and the friend and that she was to people, the sister that she was to people, and I think really the person that all these people miss. So this first email was written on Monday, December 15th, 2003, and it says, "Hey ladies, one more final and a paper. Did everyone get tons of snow? UMass sucks at plowing and my little Saturn got stuck. Now I'm screwed for tomorrow. Parking services can shove it. Anyway, I feel like I haven't seen anyone in years, but the stories are great. Carly, hope you feel better, and same to Aaron Jones. I had that in Florida on spring break. Anyway, Bill is coming up the 20th, and we're seeing a Duke game in NY, then heading to Hanson. Actually, Hanover, to stay with Kathleen. Julie is coming home on the 23rd. Woo! And we plan on going to Dane Cook. I hope everyone can come. Then off to Ohio. But when do you girls go back to school? My 8 a.m. final got moved to 6:30 p.m., which didn't work out as well as I'd hoped, because I slept all day. Ha, screw it. I'm in a great mood. Hope you all have more motivation than I do. See you soon, Maura."
Okay, and then what about the second one?
"Maybe I can lighten the email mood. UMass had crosswalks with pretty much railroad barriers because so many people have gotten hit / had accidents. I think there were 7 last year. Not much to say about the rashes, though. Katie, what do crabs eat? Do they need a little aquarium? Ha, I'm jealous. Ready for this? Dane Cook is playing at UMass February 12th, and we went to get tickets, and it was sold out. I missed out again, but I did some research, and he plays in Storrs, Connecticut, February 12th, not too far from UMass Worcester, Providence. Tickets are $10 and go on sale Monday, so let me know if anyone's interested. I imagine they will be hard to get, as usual. Take care, girls. Maura."
And when was that written?
So that was written on Thursday, January 29th, 2004. That's the last email that Maura sent on this group email of 7 girls, all these friends from high school. They had this group email, and this was the last one they ever got from her.
She makes a joke in there about crabs because her friend Katie had just gotten pet hermit crabs for her birthday. So that was actually a joke, which is actually a pretty good joke. And then she also mentions hit and runs and accidents, there being 7 the previous year. Doesn't sound to me, I mean, I'm just an amateur, but it doesn't sound to me like this is someone who did any kind of hit and run and, you know, would have been making light of it or, you know, even mentioning it at all. I know the Patrice Vassy accident happened after this, but there was some speculation maybe she hit someone besides Patrice Vassy because there were a few other hit and runs on campus that year. So I would, just looking at the writing, lean towards I don't think that probably happened. And again, she's talking about Dane Cook and tickets going on sale. It just, to me, does not sound like someone who is trying to run away or someone who is trying to kill herself. And she was very excited about seeing Dane Cook, which
it's inexplicable. It sounds like,
well, you gotta place yourself back in that time. Yeah. And I saw Dane Cook actually a couple times. And, you know, he put on a great show. At this point, I probably wouldn't be going to see Dane Cook, you know, do some stand-up. But at that time, he was very, very funny and known as the most popular stand-up comedian.
Especially amongst college.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep, and he's from Massachusetts. He had a really large following.
Exactly. And it says, Dane Cook is our favorite comedian. We've seen all his shows live several times together. So Maura had seen Dane Cook at least two or three times, it sounded like, already.
The only thing I think that I really get out of this email that perhaps would benefit from some further investigation is whether she actually bought tickets that Monday. I've never heard that she did. I've never heard that she didn't. I don't know either way, but might be helpful to know whether she had bought those tickets and, you know, whether they were found in her dorm room and she was planning on coming back to get them. I'm not sure.
Do you guys agree that this, I mean, this doesn't sound like someone who's suicidal.
No, I mean, I do think that a lot can change in a week, especially when you're dealing with a high stress environment at school, you're dealing with a long distance relationship. I don't necessarily think we can take this and say that it's a clear picture into her mental state on February 9th. But yeah, I do think that this does seem like a young woman who has a lot to look forward to in her life, who's engaged in friendships that she cares about and who's making plans.
Yeah. And they're both written the same way. There's a lack of any sort of punctuation, especially in the second one. You know, there's no periods in there and there's no capitalization on it's like she's kind of writing like stream of conscious in both emails. Banging it out and then on to the next thing. It doesn't seem like it's not hurried, but just excited.
What I take from this is that Maura was someone who shared what was going on in her life with her friends, and maybe not all the most serious stuff, but these were girls that she was keeping in touch with for sure.
So I just want to bring up something that you had mentioned didn't make it into the 17 article, but is interesting in itself. This is a statement from Vanessa telling you that, and do we know where she got this? Where it says her 86 Saturn careened off the road into the woods, barely missing a tree. She was okay since the airbag deployed, but the car wasn't drivable. The radiator was pushed back into the fan, and the few feet of packed snow where she had landed wouldn't let her wheels turn. So we can, I just want to put that out there because this was something that was given to Vanessa, correct? During the time that she was writing the article.
Yeah, correct. I mean, this is information that she sourced in researching the article. And this, you know, was a sentence from an earlier version. But I think part of why it didn't maybe make it into the magazine was just knowing your audience and knowing that I think a lot of the readers of 17 Magazine probably weren't even driving and so wouldn't necessarily understand what would or would not make a car drivable, and that it wasn't really adding anything to the piece. But I'm not sure who provided that specific account of the damage to the car.
Well, it's certainly providing us with a piece of the condition of the car. And so even though she feels like this didn't contribute to the article in 17 due to the readership, it certainly contributes to what we're doing here. Important things like barely missing a tree. That's a pretty specific statement. And the condition of the car with the radiator pushed back into the fan and not being able to move the wheels in a few feet of packed snow might put to rest some of the theorizing that goes into how the damage occurred on Maura's car that night.
But we know that the car started later.
We know the car started, yeah. And this car can totally start even if the radiator...
Be drivable.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't drivable because of the... You couldn't turn the wheels because it was in the snow. But you can start the car and drive it, I mean, as far as it can handle if the radiator is pushed back into the fan. You don't really need the fan to operate the car. It's just going to overheat. Based on this description, she wouldn't have been able to go very far at all, but it does make sense that Fred was able to start the car later on at LaVoy's.
Okay, and then Billy Rausch has a pretty good quote here that Vanessa took down Maura did drink, but not a lot, favoring wine spritzers and never drinking hard liquor. In the 2 years we went out, I only saw her drunk 2 or 3 times, says Billy Rausch, her boyfriend.
That's interesting, yeah, because, I mean, this was a long-distance relationship, too, so who knows?
The wine spritzers would fall in line with what Kate said that that they were drinking that night before Maura crashed her dad's Toyota.
Another piece from this 17 article that wasn't put into the actual printed copy is the account of Butch meeting Maura at the time of the accident. And I don't know, just you hear so much stuff about how it went down with him asking her if she needs, you know, do you need help? You need me to call AAA? And what is quoted here from him is he spoke to her and said, I'll call the police and fire department. Why don't you come into my house? You can get warm and wait. No, said Maura firmly. I'll wait here.
One of the things I thought was interesting about this account is that it makes no mention of Maura asking Butch not to call the police, which is something, again, I think over time we've just assumed as fact that Maura specifically asked Butch not to call the police. Whereas in this article, which was written very soon after and has incredibly great firsthand sources, she says that she's going to wait in her car for the police and the fire department. So what that means for her actions following, I'm not sure, but I do think that this to me is just another reminder to be careful to really look and see where a lot of my assumptions about this case, about that night specifically, and about the accident come from. Do they come from real statements, real facts, or do they come from just things that I've read over and over until they're just in my brain?
Yep. And this is about as close as we can get to the actual incident. And I've never heard, unless it's buried in there somewhere and I just forgot about it, but I've never heard Butch offering to call police and fire and then offering an invitation into his house so she can get warm and wait.
Okay, well, thank you very much, KF, for joining us here on this episode and really helping us with all this research and investigation. We really appreciate it. We will probably bring you back on at some point in the future to talk about what else you've uncovered and are trying to help us with. So thank you very much, and thank you everybody for listening.
Yeah, and definitely have you back on because there's a lot more information out there that you've uncovered, and we just, you know, got to sort it out. I mean, even as we're closing up right now, I'm reading more stuff that is in here that we just simply don't have time to cover right now. So thank you for finally putting a voice to all the investigation that's going on behind the scenes.